Today I have my lovely guest Chiz Wakonka with me. And Chiz, I've known for some time now, but I'm going to introduce her formal title. She is currently the head of Global Financial Crimes, and she's legal advisory for EMEA at a very large investment bank. Got that correct, haven't I? She does loads of things. I wanted to get that title correct. She's an experienced investigations lawyer, and she was previously a junior diplomat assigned to the UN Security Council. So she's had a very illustrious career at a very young age already. We'll come on to that. She was educated at the University of Cambridge, where she achieved her law degree, and also at Columbia University in New York, where she achieved her master's in law. And I think with Chiz, the reason I wanted her to come on is that she is the epitome of a strong working woman. And she seems to be making everything work. I know her pretty well. And from what I can see, she not only has a flourishing career, which most of us work very hard to achieve, but also she's very rigorous with her health and fitness. She's a vegan as well, mainly. Mother to three little children, thriving, and she'll tell you a bit more about those, and still finds time to be a thought leader in her industry and a philanthropist as well. And today what I want to do is pick Chiz's brains about the keys to her success, because I think very often when we're in the middle of it as individuals, we can't always see our success. And so I'm going to have to drag that out of her, because she's a very humble individual. But I think, as you'll see, you know, she's achieved so much. And so I want to find out the keys to your success, Chiz, and, you know, how you make it all work, ranging from your health to your mindset, to your career, your relationships, your children, and just looking so great as well. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And we'll call this one the one with the autumn dresses. We've just realised that we're both dressed for autumn. And I think if we start off with your story, I mean, just tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to get here.
Well, first off, thanks for that introduction. I don't think I've ever been introduced in such glowing terms.
Well, there are many more glowing things I could say.
Thank you. So I am an East London girl. My parents emigrated from Nigeria when I was just before I was two, I think. So I was born in Nigeria. We moved to the UK and settled in East London. Educated in East London, regular schools, comprehensive schooling the whole way, really enjoyed school. Probably
so school was good for you?
More than most children.
Yeah.
It was really a joy for me. I enjoyed every single day, every minute of it, every scrap of learning. I loved it all. That was helpful, because it meant I found sort of academic life fun and stimulating, and got to Cambridge on the back of that.
And why do you think you found it so fun and enjoyable? Do you think that was like an attitude thing, or would you say that you were lucky in that respect? Or because you went, as you say, to very ordinary schools in East London. I myself went to some pretty rough schools in Southeast London, and so I had varying experiences. But like you, I really enjoyed school because I was so focused on learning and I loved progress. But it wasn't without its challenges, I have to say. So what do you think made you enjoy it so much?
So culturally, my heritage is Nigerian, as I've said, and culturally we are bred to really prize learning in Nigerian communities, to really prize learning as the foundation of your success in life. So it was kind of trained into us that you will excel. It's expected that you will excel no matter what context you find yourself in, notwithstanding that you're going to communal garden comprehensive schools in East London. You will still find your path to success. So that was an expectation that was placed on us. And then I think I also just grew up with a love of learning, love of learning and a love of reading in particular. Yeah. So when I was very little, my favourite place was the library, and it was just a real refuge for me. It wasn't the most straightforward of childhoods. I spent some time in the care sector in East London, and, you know, that wasn't not an ideal an ideal start in life, and it was definitely unsettling, definitely felt a sense of being displaced. But one of the things that really anchored me was Canning Town Library, which I'm not even sure is there anymore, but it was my treasured safe space. Yeah. And I would just devour the books in the library at every given opportunity. And it just, it stimulated my imagination, stimulated my curiosity, gave me an escape. And I think that was really the root of my love of learning.
Because some people who go through that and any other challenges in their life, you know, I think we all have an escape of some sort, you know, and that's to fulfill needs of security and variety and significance and belonging and all of that. And I mean, you know, it sounds like you chose you use the word refuge, but it sounds like you chose your refuge or your escape in something that was very, very positive for you long term. But others in that situation, you say, you know, you spent some time in the care sector, I don't know how long, and tell us that in a moment. But others in that situation may find an escape in something else, which is much less positive. Mm. So what made you take those positive choices, do you think? And how long were you in the care sector? Tell us a bit more about childhood for you at home.
Yeah, so there were three of us, me and my two older siblings at the time. And I believe we were in care for about 2 to 3 years in sort of, from I think I was about four when we began in care, three or four. And at various points we were split up, the three of us, and I think on one, maximum two of our placements we were all together. So it was really unsettling, didn't have a sense of permanence. And I read an article just the other day about how care experienced children in general experience worse outcomes within the criminal justice space, and I just was reading it with horror, but also just gratitude, deep and profound gratitude, that notwithstanding what I experienced, I've nonetheless been able to just find my way down a different path. Because it's, and I can't speak to whether it's something innate, intrinsic, or whether it's just dumb luck that I found a good book, was able to read, and that led me down a path of loving literature, and that, you know, kept me sort of kind of on the straight and narrow.
Yeah. Did the same apply to your siblings?
We've all sort of established ourselves professionally. I wouldn't say everyone in my sibling core, there are five of us, has such a passion for reading as I do, but we were all expected to and had this sort of drive to accomplish instilled in us. Yeah.
Very inspiring to hear. So you told me a story that about what inspired you and who inspired you to become a lawyer. And this was well before you joined university and while you were still at school. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so I was walking down the street. I was at secondary school at this point. I must have been about 14 or 15. And I was walking towards there was a Crown Court, I believe, on the high street. And a man wandered out in robes and a white wig. And I recognised the look as somebody who was a lawyer of some description, a barrister. And I'd never met a barrister before in my life, but had it in mind that I might want to be a lawyer at some point, and it would be an interesting path for me, but had no family connections, no one had mentored me from the legal world. So I just wandered up to this man and said...
Were you on your own?
Yeah. Said, excuse me, are you a lawyer? Are you a barrister? And he said, yes, I am a barrister. And I said, oh, I might like to be a barrister or a lawyer one day. And we just got chatting in a pretty superficial way, because what's a senior barrister going to have to say to a 14-year-old upstart? Oh. But he was really kind and really... generously gave me his contact details and said, look, if you are really interested, keep my details, and when the time comes, get in touch, and maybe we can arrange a mini pupillage in my chambers for you. And he explained what a mini pupillage was, because I had no frame of reference for it. And I did keep his details, and then I did get in touch, and he true to his word, arranged a mini pupillage. I spent some time in chambers, and that was my first real exposure to life as a lawyer. And
how old were you then?
I think I was 16.
So it's probably
16,
a sort
17.
Of a work placement as part of school
maybe
or
17.
Something.
But it was fascinating. I remember going into the temple for the first time on my own, and like, I can't remember, I got like an egg roll for my lunch because it was the most affordable thing. But I remember feeling the energy and the buzz of lawyerly life in London and thinking, my goodness, could this really be something I can do? Could this be a place I can find myself in, a space I could occupy? And yeah, it was exhilarating.
It's, I mean, there's so many sort of little lessons that are popping up from that, you know, right from when you were younger and, you know, you had these challenging moments and you moved around and, but you chose to find solace in something that was really positive for you. And we all have choices at times, don't we, how we deal with challenges. And then, you know, sometimes we see something, we see an opportunity, a moment that could be really life-changing, and sometimes we're too fearful to take it. Because you could just as easily have walked past that guy and just thought it but not said anything, but you jumped in and you spoke to him, and then, you know, you would have had to have taken the next step, which was to keep his details and to follow through. Because again, sometimes, you know, we'll meet someone, we'll be in networking or something, and we think, oh, you know, why would they want to speak to me? Or they're going to be too busy, they won't remember me. But, you know, we should do these follow-ups, because I know in my own career, it's just been those little times, those little things where I've thought, I will respond to that email, I will fill that form in to win a contract or something like that. And then, you know, from that comes great things. So
I think it's testament to youth. You know, when you're young and you don't have the filters that you develop as you get older. And I just was a little bit more fearless and just at ease with my curiosity in a way that I wasn't the older I got. And I had to really be more conscious about giving in to my curiosity and consciously networking. Whereas I wouldn't have called what I was doing there networking.
No, you just thought you asked a question and that was that. You didn't think too much about it. Yeah, it's a good point. So that obviously stood you in good stead for when you applied to university and you went to Cambridge. And I know you came from a background where, you know, you didn't really have much careers advice. So how was that?
It was great. I was really lucky. And then I had some really fantastic teachers in my school. And when I look back at just the environment they had to teach in and the challenges they faced, I'm so grateful that they gave me time and, you know, brain space. They must have been at capacity given everything else they had to deal with in the school environment. But they really did. I did have a handful of teachers that invested in me and spoke to me of what was possible. In the history of my school, we hadn't ever had anyone go to Oxbridge. And we also didn't have anyone do some of the extracurricular things that they encouraged me to do, like public speaking. And I remember one of my English teachers encouraging me to start doing some public speaking competitions. And there was a championship that I got to the final of, and the final was speaking in the House of Commons. And I remember the day before when I was rehearsing with her, I remember her saying to me, "Chiz, you could actually win this, you know." And I don't think I'd ever really contemplated that was possible, that was within my reach. And it was the first time I really expanded my notion of what was possible. And I did win. And the same teacher said to me, "Have you thought about applying to Oxbridge?" And that just set the ball rolling. And again, she presented to me what was possible. In a way that I hadn't previously contemplated, because I just hadn't seen it. And I don't necessarily believe that if you don't see it, you can't be it. Because I certainly didn't see any of these things. I didn't have clear role models, having walked this path before. But I did choose to be it because I accepted that it was possible, that it was within the realm of what was possible for me. Getting to Cambridge was a real turning point for me. I felt like I stepped into a space that I didn't belong in, but I met like-minded people, I made some lifelong friends, and again, just an incredible seat of learning. It broadened my horizons in so many different ways. I mean, there were absolutely challenges. It was a really interesting time to go to Cambridge. It was after, a few years after Stephen Lawrence had been killed, and there weren't many black faces around the university, and certain figures in the university were quite keen to be seen to be doing the right thing, and so they sort of started off some nascent diversity initiatives, which ended up with me being on the prospectus and on the brochure and interviewed on television because there were a handful of black faces at the university. So when I volunteered to do that, and I was happy to do it at the time. But in retrospect, I don't know whether I should have been so willing to be the face of Cambridge. But, you know, I mean, it did me no harm. Mm-hmm. But it was, that was an interesting aspect of my time.
So yeah. It was great. Again, I think it's a good example of you just taking an opportunity as it came, not looking into it too much.
Yeah.
I mean, I think from what you've said, one point that stood out is the impact of the teachers and what they said to you and how they mentored you. I think if anyone wants to, is thinking about being a teacher and wants to listen to my episode, I interviewed some teachers and what it's, I want to be a teacher. And, you know, they talked about what that job's like to do. And we all know it can be very challenging.
Yeah.
And the turnover of teachers is enormously high, not because they don't love teaching, but because of everything that goes with it. But I think it's really good to remember and reflect on the fact that, you know, a few well-chosen words from a teacher or a mentor, if you're a mentor in business, you know, and I know, Jiz, you know, that's an area that you're interested in as well. You know, if you are a mentor or a teacher or even just someone's manager, just a few well-chosen words from you, you never know the impact that they will make and how they can really, really change someone's career. And sometimes people are very competent, but they just need to be made aware of it and told about it. It's funny, I don't know why, but very often we will do more for other people than we will for ourselves, and to get that external approval is just really important to us sometimes. And the beautiful thing is that we're all capable of giving that external approval if we choose to do it. And so I think the role of a mentor and a teacher is so critical. But so you completed your degree, and then you had a pretty flourishing career right from the start. You went with very well-known law firms.
Through
to where you are now. Tell us briefly about that, and then we'll get into what it's like to do that job and a bit more about life now.
I had a really incredibly busy time the first part of my career, working for some heavy-hitting law firms, you know, no sense of work-life balance, but then you're in your 20s and you don't need one, nor do you want one, because it's all just kind of fun and exciting and you have the energy for it. So it was right in the heart of the city. It was a really dynamic time. The firms I worked for were corporate firms, so all of our clients were financial institutions, or multinationals with really complex issues to deal with. And you do your training contracts, so you rotate seats to different departments within the firm, and until you qualify, and I qualified as a litigator, with a sort of side order of investigations. And that was fortuitous, because it meant that I ultimately, when I decided to take my career break and go to Columbia and do my master's, I was well positioned to then pivot to being a junior diplomat on the Security Council, because I'd done this sort of international law investigative litigation work, which just lends itself to multilateral diplomacy.
You sort of changed direction a little bit. So tell us about that. Was that on purpose, or was that fortuitous? Or
the turning point was going and doing the LLM. I would say it was a good opportunity for me to step away from private practice and reimmerse myself in learning, which is a thing that I love, clearly.
In New York as well.
To New York.
How long were you there for?
I ended up there for over 2 years in the end. I planned to only be there for a year and then extended and extended because you do, because it's New York and it's amazing.
Yeah. So
it opened my eyes to what more I could do and be as a lawyer, and how I'm really a polymath. I think many of us lawyers are. We're not just black letter law, contractual reviewers opining on legal language and documentation. We are relationship managers, we are marketers, we are skilled negotiators, and all of those skills are readily transferable, and I deployed them as a diplomat, and that was just an absolutely mind-blowing experience. Yeah. It was extraordinary. I blagged my way to a job working for the Nigerian delegation on the Security Council, unpaid to begin with, because I really wanted to do it. And they ultimately then gave me my own portfolio of Security Council issues, which were all of the cross-cutting issues on the council agenda, so not country-specific. So I was dealing with topics like women, peace and security, children and armed conflict, sexual violence and armed conflict. And then I also had an agenda item called emerging threats.
Right. And when you say you blagged your way into that role, you must have met someone again. That sounds like the same scenario as bumping into the curly haired wig guy.
Sort of, but in a remote sense. I looked up on Google the names of the heads of the different sort of coverage units within the delegation, found their email addresses and sent them my CV and a covering letter and said, this is me. This is my professional background. I'm currently in New York.
Yeah.
I'm really interested in foreign service and getting some insight into diplomacy and applying what I've learned in the international law space in practical terms. And one of them got back to me. And that's all it took was just one.
Exactly. And these things, that's it. It is only one, isn't it? And these things do work. I remember there was a particular company that I really wanted to do some business with and just couldn't get through the gatekeepers, you know, and it was messing about for several months and ended up just looking up the chief exec, knowing the format of the email addresses, did, you know, first name dot, surname at, and just thought, let's hope. And sure enough, he comes back.
Yeah.
And the next thing is the head of procurement talking to me. And the next thing, we end up with a contract with that company. It really is worth doing these impromptu contacts. And I know you have to do a lot of them. But this, you know, this, especially when we're running recruitment businesses and people with, and training businesses for young people trying to find their first job. And, you know, I would say to someone, well, they say, I've tried everything. You know, I've been for so many interviews, I just can't find anything. And I say, well, how many interviews have you been? You know, and finally you pull it out of them, maybe one or two or none.
Mm.
And how many jobs have you actually applied for? And it would be none. And how many impromptu things? Like, certainly none.
Mm.
You know, so it's so worth it to follow your sort of inclination. If you wake up and think, I think I'll just email this person. I think I'll just ask that question. I think I'll just make that call.
Yeah.
That's very often where opportunities come from, isn't
it? Inspired action. I agree.
Inspired action.
Yeah.
So tell us a bit more about life now. I mean, we just detoured over to New York for a bit, but you came back to London and you did a series of steps and you've ended up now in your current position where you have a lot of responsibility, I know. What's life like now?
It's busy.
Yeah.
I have 3 children, 7, 4, and 1.
Yeah.
So every day starts with a bang and ends with a bang because they are high energy. Job is pretty demanding. So working with you has been an absolute boon because it has been so supportive of just me maintaining a good level of energy to keep all of the plates spinning.
Well, we'll come on to that, energy levels and everything, because very often, I mean, you know, when we look at your strategies and how you got to where you are, it seems all very much business related. We haven't really spoken about physical energy or you know, even the mental ability to sort of sustain and focus like that. You were saying in your 20s when everyone is like that. I think not everyone is like that, even in their 20s, I think. But when you are, you know, you think sometimes that other people are. But it does stem from energy. We are a machine at the end of the day, and we have to find that fuel from somewhere. I mean, to where you are now from the UN, it's what, 8 years? How many years?
More than that now, maybe 12.
About 12 years. And in 12 years, not only have you achieved this really senior level in your industry with far more to go, I know, just looking at what you've achieved so far, but also 3 children. And, you know, that takes its toll as well. When you're out of the workplace for a bit, you know, children inevitably have their differences in terms of the demands on us and everything that have demands on our body. Mm. I know, you know, you're happily married, but, you know, there's a relationship to maintain, there's friendships to maintain. So how was that, you know, in the last, your oldest is 7.
Yeah.
So that last 7 years, I mean, how's that been? Because there will be lots of working mothers who are probably keen to know how you've got this amazing physique. So we'll talk about that in a moment. But just how you kept it going, kept getting their promotions, kept building this thriving family.
It's difficult to sketch a roadmap for it, because a lot of it just happened by me, by sheer force of will, staying in the workforce, notwithstanding having multiple maternity leaves,
yeah,
and staying on a full-time basis, not dropping down to a 4-day week or a 3-day week, which, you know, might have been a good thing for my first or second child, but I chose not to, and my husband and I both work full-time. So that has presented challenges, and it just means we've really had to be hot on logistics as a household.
Right. Yeah.
Making sure we're clear on timings, on schedules, on, you know, getting appropriate wraparound care. But it has been a whirlwind of 7 years.
Yeah.
When my husband and I met, we were then married within a year, and yeah, I had our son the month after we were married.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
So it has been a breakneck 7 or so years,
yeah,
and we've had with 3 children fairly evenly spaced,
yeah,
in that period. And 3 maternity leaves. I took a year off my first child, 5 months for my second, and I had 8 months for our last child.
Yeah.
The mat leave, my first maternity leave, was blissful and lovely, apart from the fact that the law firm I was working for went into insolvency while I was on maternity leave.
Wow.
So we were all then made
yeah,
redundant, and there was a challenge to like find a new role whilst I was still nursing this baby, and
yeah,
7 months into what was planned to be a year's maternity leave, trying to find another job, but that worked out for the best.
I really want to jump into how you got that job.
We'll
do that in a minute. There's lots of questions there.
And then with my middle child, a few months after having her, I was just on the sofa scrolling and was reached out to on LinkedIn by a headhunter who had this role at my current employer, and said, you know, would really like to put you forward for this role. And I wasn't looking to leave my firm at that time. I was fully prepared to go back after 8 to 12 months. And I ended up saying, fine, I'll go for it, and getting the job. But then it required me to start pretty much immediately. So I had a pretty truncated
maternity leave. 5 months, yeah.
Yeah. This time around, I gave myself 8 months,
yeah,
which was a healthy balance,
yeah,
between the two. And yeah.
And it sounds, you said about logistics, it sounds like you and your husband very much aligned with that, and you're on the same page as to what needs to be done and who does what and demarcation of responsibilities and everything. Is that how,
yeah,
you made it work?
Yeah, we both fundamentally want the same things for, yeah, our family, but also for ourselves as individuals.
Mm.
I think we're both reasonably driven, you know, and we agreed before we had kids that neither of us needed to take our foot off the gas professionally. We would find a way to make it work. Mm. And less than until one of us says, I need a timeout, we would figure it out. And it didn't need to have a detrimental impact on us or on the children, so long as it was properly managed and you stay on top of it the whole time and you're both committed to the project, as it were. And so we have been really lucky to have to be in a position to have after school nannies. Now that two of them are in school as opposed to preschool or nursery, they have a breakfast club or an after school club when they need it. And when they were babies, they were in nurseries that had a fairly long day. Mm. So we could do a pickup at six or after six. So those things made it manageable. And we really just maximise our time with them. We have good quality time in the mornings. Everyone is up from 6:30. I tend to be up a little bit earlier, as you know. But everyone starts to sort of rise at about 6:30. And that means we bank some good time with them at the beginning of the day.
Yeah.
And we try to both be at home before bedtime. So when the after-school nanny is putting them to bed, we get to spend a little bit of time with them then as well.
Yeah. And it seems like, you know, you have a sort of a story. I always talk about people's story, and situations are how you describe them. And I was just listening to you describing the story of the way that you bring the children up, and, you know, it will work, and there is no need for us, either of us, to take our foot off the pedal, and we will spend quality time with the children. And so that's a story. Mm. That's almost like you've defined the way it's going to be, as opposed to, I think it's going to be really challenging. Which of course, both stories would be correct. I think, you know, it's going to be difficult for me to do this, that and the other. And but it's what we focus on. We do get what we focus on. And this is just such a good example of that, is that you're not saying that there are not challenges. I know you've had times where baby has been unwell, and, you know, I've spoken to you and you've been in the doctor's waiting room or in the hospital, but you make it work, don't you, by focusing on what can work and how you can work around it. But sometimes, you know, we do feel tired, and there are days where, with all the will in the world, we feel drained and maybe not quite so positive. Do you have days like that? And if you do, what do you do about it?
Frequently. I often have days where I just feel like I'm not necessarily equal to the challenge of the day. Sometimes, you know, one of the three kids is unwell, or just being a grumpy toddler or a grumpy child.
Yeah.
And you don't want to start your day in a state of conflict, but sometimes it's unavoidable. And you have to just then make some hard decisions. How am I going to reframe the day? Where am I going to draw energy from? What can I summon to be my best self in the context I'm going to find myself in when I get to the office? Or how am I going to, you know, not lose it with my son or one of my daughters? You know, it's just the job of constantly checking in with oneself. But it is far from perfect. The system that we have is far from perfect. We just, what binds us is the will, will to make it
to
work.
To make it work, yeah. Are you able to compartmentalise? You know, so when you're in work, obviously I know that you have, like, some pretty serious things to deal with, a lot of responsibility, like I said. How do you manage that?
I think in the main I am able to compartmentalise, but there is no... So within my organisation, we don't talk about work-life balance. We talk about work-life continuum.
Yeah.
Because it's inevitable that the one bleeds into the other.
Yeah.
You can never draw a hard line between the two, especially post-COVID. So I, at the moment, I'm on a working model where I do 2 days a week working from home, 3 days a week in the office, and that may change in the future. I may spend more time in the office. But at the moment, that's the model that works for our household setup. But it's easier to compartmentalise when I'm physically in the building, when I'm in Canary Wharf. But whichever way you slice it, I can get a call from nursery at any given time of the day, or from school at any given time of the day, or and then just having to manage dental appointments, doctor's appointments, it's
school holidays.
School holidays. Yeah. My God, we've just come out of the summer holidays, which is obviously a blessing to have all that time with them, but presents its own challenge for I can't take 6 weeks off of work to be with you every day. It is hard. Mm. It is hard. I'm not gonna lie.
But you make it work, and as you said, so one part of that is having a story that says that you're going to make it work. Another part is being aligned with a partner and having the very same clear intention. So let's get on to the other things that fuel Shiz now, which is, you know, the energy. And so I met you about 7-8 months ago, maybe 9 months ago now, and we did a bit of an overhaul of your daily routine and your fitness and everything. And I have to say, I've met you physically twice, lots and lots of times online, and you are such an implementer. I mean, you know, you don't particularly question either if you see a result, and you do what so many of these gurus out there say to do, is that, you know, success breeds clues. See someone who's got what you want and see how they do it, and then just follow suit. And I think, you know, you saw that with me in terms of my transformation for fitness, and we gave you some guidelines, and you follow them absolutely, you know, to the letter. And you had the added, so let's say, not disadvantage, but complication of being vegan as well. So your nutrition was slightly more complicated to achieve the nutrition levels that we wanted. And obviously coupling that with, you weren't able to fit in going to the gym every 5 minutes.
Yeah.
So you've done a lot of your fitness from home. And then you've had, you know, children to deal with and sleepless nights and things like that. And yet you still managed to implement this morning routine that we always advocate. So tell us about that journey and how that's helped you with achieving everything, because I can see the transformation, but when you talk about it, I can hear it as well.
Yeah, it's been an absolute blessing to be able to have been on the program and to start it, you know, basically at the end of my mat leave, going back and returning to the workplace. It was the perfect sort of anchoring of my transition journey back to work, because I, you know, you are postnatal and your body doesn't really feel like your own. I was still breastfeeding. I still am breastfeeding. I had a really, really tough pregnancy. I had hyperemesis gravidarum. So I was, and I only recovered from that upon giving birth. So I was coming out of a pretty tough year and a half. My mind was cloudy because I was sleep deprived, and my nutrition was, who knows what was happening. I couldn't even tell you what I was eating, but it wasn't good for me. I was fueling for, you know, probably far too much sugar, far too many refined carbs, just to sort of stay functional. And I knew that I wasn't my best self. But there was a point of decision where I, you know, my husband and I agreed that this baby would be our last baby. We call her our bonus baby. And I think that having that marker put down was good for me, because it meant I could say, okay, well, I've spent the last 6 or so years growing children, raising children, feeding children with my body. I would like to reclaim some of that now. Surely now I can create time and space in our life for me and for reclaiming some sense of self. And your program gave me a fantastic blueprint for that. And I spoke to someone I know through work, who had worked with you previously before I agreed to work with you. And she said to me, you know, it's an outstanding program. Angela is an incredible person. She said, but you will get out of it what you put in. And so the abiding rule that I remind myself of when I haul myself out of bed at 4:45 of the morning is to trust the process. And even though those first few months of doing that morning routine were tough, because the baby was and still is a baby, I am still co-sleeping, I am still breastfeeding. Actually, the energy and the fueling that I've got out of doing this work has helped me feel less sleep deprived. Yeah. And I have far more mental clarity. I'm able to plan, structure the day, coordinate things, express myself more clearly. Mm. Because I think, I don't know a great deal about the science of it, but pregnancy and that immediate postnatal period does something to your brain where you feel you can, or at least perhaps let me just speak for myself. Mm. I felt a little duller. I felt a little bit out of remove from things you would ordinarily just be able to touch and see and feel. And I feel things more immediately now. Mm. I feel more in tune. I think that's what it is.
Yeah.
So even though the externalities haven't changed, I still am running around like a headless chicken doing a busy, demanding full-time job with 3 children and with an incredibly supportive husband, but it is bananas. Mm. I'm better equipped to do it. I feel mentally and physically stronger than I did 8-9 months ago, and I'm so grateful.
Well, I think, as you say, you know, you put all the effort in, and when you did that, you know, you get the results. And I think that we shock ourselves about how good we can actually feel. And often I see this, you know, when people maybe are introduced to a new way of eating, maybe they think that they can't possibly be going to the gym that frequently because they just don't have the time, but they try it and they suddenly go to another level of how good they feel. And it's really quick as well. And then they find that everything else miraculously becomes easier. And it's not that the challenges go away. It's not a coincidence, though. It's just that their perspective, again, on things is easier, they're clearer headed.
Yeah. And you stop putting walls up for yourself. You stop sort of landing on an obstacle and saying, that's why I can't do it. You actually flip the script and think, well, clearly I can do this. Let's figure out how.
Yeah. And what would you say then to people in your position where, and this is men as well, where, you know, they feel like all 24 hours are accounted for? With men, it tends to be because of work, mainly work. But with women, there's children in the equation as well. Still, the men don't really mention the children as much, but they do mention, you know, having time with their family. What would you say to them when they say, well, I just don't have time to go to the gym. I'd love to, but I can't.
Yeah, I would say that everyone has the same 24 hours in the day, but we don't all have the same 24 hours. Yeah. So you have to personally find where in that day you can claw back something for yourself. And I couldn't find any give, I couldn't find any flex in my day without getting up far earlier than I'd ever routinely done before. And it was a hard habit to build, but I'm really glad I built that habit because I actually perform better during the day. It works with our daily logistics. I'm acutely aware that I'm deeply privileged in that I can get up at 4:45 and wander downstairs to the gym, which is our garage, which we turned our garage into a gym, rather than having to sort of get on the tube or get on the bus or drive to a gym. Yeah. It makes it much more achievable that I just go downstairs to the garage and I do a 45 minute lifting session. These days I now do like a 10 minute HIIT thingy on the treadmill because it just gives me a little boost. I quite like the endorphins that it gives you. And then I stroll back into the house. And
what time is it done by then?
So by the time I'm done, it's about 6:15, 6:30, because if you include journaling, meditation, that sort of reflective period at the beginning and then going into the gym.
Yeah. And let's talk about that as well, because people will put up the same barriers with regard to meditation. So, you know, if I ask people if they considered meditating, they say, well, maybe I have, but, you know, I'm not sure, I don't know how to do it, or I just don't have time to do it. If I try and do it at night, I fall asleep. I certainly don't have time to do it in the morning. And so they don't see they never achieve the benefits of it. So tell us a bit more about your experience with that, how that's been.
I've really enjoyed it. And I've, over the years, really tried to convince myself to establish a meditation practice. And I've used Headspace for years, but really intermittently. Mm. And occasionally felt like it was making a difference to me, but never maintained the habit, never did it on a continuous basis. But this time round, it's been far more continuous. It's not every single, I don't get to do it every single day, but when I do it on a fairly consistent basis, I do find it gives me a sense of expansion, peace, alignment. It supports my mental clarity. The reflective journaling practice I do after I meditate is also great, not just from a sort of brain dump perspective, but also sitting in that possible, sitting within the art of the possible. And that the expansion I get from meditation allows me to do that and really begin to just visualize what else is there. Who else can I be? What more can I do? And I enjoy the luxury of being able to just journal about that after I meditate, or just be an energetic being for a while, which sounds really woo-woo. So I don't even journal anything concrete or material or no planning or anything. It's just enjoying just being an energetic being without, before everyone's awake, before is any noise or activity.
Just being. Yeah. They say we are human beings, not human doings.
Doings, exactly.
So on the woo-woo side, obviously we've done some work on on manifestation as well. How's that helped you?
Again, it's helped me become what I believe.
Right.
And I wouldn't describe myself as a success. I would describe myself very much as a work in progress. I think I will always be, but I'm happy with that. Yeah. And I'm happy with the fact that I'm going to always be growing, always be learning. Manifestation has helped, or understanding how manifestation works has given me a sense of what I can grow into.
Yeah.
It's helped me sort of think in a little bit more detail, who is it that I want to be? Taken together, everything, the sum of my experiences, the sum of my choices, what has that collection of experiences enabled me to now think, okay, what's next? And what can I create in my mind as a first step, and then in reality?
And I think with manifestation, you've got to give yourself time, first of all, to get into that mode, to get into that mode of visualization. But that's not just writing a list and forgetting about it. It is then dwelling on it, like you said, and just sort of being in that picture. So seeing yourself in that picture, really properly visualizing it, giving yourself time to think, oh, and this, maybe that instead, how about this? But then a big part of it in between meditation sessions is the stuff of letting go of resistance. Yeah. We talk about this a lot, and sometimes people ask me about that, and I think what you've described in terms of the way you see things, that you will find a way around something, that you'll make something work this way or that way, that is actually letting go of resistance, because the opposite to that is focusing on why things can't work, how things possibly, you know, it's going to be impossible to resolve this one. Oh my goodness, this is going to be terrible. You know, that sort of phraseology that you hear from people, that's holding on to resistance. Mm. Whereas saying, you know, okay, well, how can I deal with this? What's the next thing to do? How can I work around this? Is really the whole process of letting go of resistance. And then, hey presto, things come into being. As we see here, you're a living example of that. So trying to sort of bring some of this together, if you had to, and this is always a hard question, but if you had to sort of try and summarize some of the main things that you know to be true about life, and we can categorize them if you want in terms of, you know, energy and nutrition, and or it can just be general things, things that you think are lessons for others if they are maybe seeking of ways to move forward.
So I think within certain confines, you can create your own reality. I remember being 34, thinking, being at a point where I was single, really, really wanted to have children. it was something I really felt I needed, or at least strongly desired at the core of my being, and was prepared to go and do it on my own. And ended up meeting my husband. We then had our son within a year. All of that is a reality that we created,
yeah,
as a sort of common enterprise, my husband and I. And then, you know, fast forward to now, the reality of the body that I'm inhabiting now is something that I visualized 8-9 months ago, when I was occupying a very different body,
yeah,
with very different energy levels. All of that was a reality that I created, that, mm-hmm, I initially built in my mind, put it down on paper, discussed with you how we would get there, what it would take, what it would require,
yeah,
to achieve. And you mapped it out for me, and we did it. I created this reality. Mm. So I think first and foremost is that, you know, obviously within certain confines, not everybody has access to a gym that is their garage. But I think in certain...
They have weights benches in their sitting room. That's where a lot of people do it from there.
And to be honest with you, yeah, when I started with you, I wasn't even prepared to go into the garage. I was using our front room.
I
remember room.
Sometimes I saw you freezing with a woolly hat and gloves and everything on, yeah.
That was the first step, yeah, of like getting brilliant out of my comfort zone. But to begin with, I was just doing weights in the living, in the front room, because, yeah, I was like, the gym was my husband's space and I couldn't conceptualize myself in there, but, yeah, eventually I did.
So you create what you focus on, you create your own reality is something you truly believe, and you've, yeah, got lots of examples of that. What other main lessons of you do you think you have in terms of what you really know about life?
I think I really do believe in the art of the possible.
Right.
My story isn't written yet. I don't know how it's going to end, where I'm going to end up, who I'm going to end up being. But so much, I have such a powerful sense that so much more is possible.
Mm-hmm.
I love what I'm doing now. I do enjoy my work. I get a great deal out of it. It's stimulating intellectually. It's high pressured,
yeah,
but I do to an extent thrive on that. But it's also gifting me new skills that I can build on in lots of other ways.
Mm.
So who knows what I'll be doing in 15, 20 years time.
Yeah.
But there is just so much that is possible. So I am firm in the belief that there are very few limits as to what is possible for oneself. Mm.
Yeah.
I also believe that hardship can be an advantage. I think you can be burnished by tough times. And I think I was certainly shaped by not having the most straightforward childhood, but feeling quite keenly that within the kernel of myself, I could do more.
Mm.
Not knowing what that more was, not seeing what that more was, in, you know, West Ham or Canning Town or Forest Gate, wherever we found ourselves at a given point, not seeing it, but just knowing instinctively that there was more. But I don't know if I would have been that driven if I hadn't had such challenges and then propelled myself in spite of some of those challenges. You know, I left home quite early.
Yeah.
But that again was, it fueled me that I was going to do really good things despite what everything happened. Else that was going on.
And that applies, I think, to people in any point in their life and challenges. You know, we could be people hope are listening to this now. Maybe they're in jobs that they don't particularly like. Maybe they're in relationships. Maybe they're in a body that they wish they could change. I mean, you can change anything. And sometimes if people right in the midst of a challenge, you know, and they really feel down, to try and change the way again, to try and change the story about that, to try and look at that as, well, what could this mean? What could this lead us to? How could this be shaping me?
Yeah.
It may not be pleasant. Not everything is.
Yeah.
Being in your garage, in the freezing cold, sometimes, I'm sure, is not pleasant. But then you come out of it and you obviously you've benefited from it.
Not only just my body changing, but also just the sense of accomplishment and thinking, actually, I'm becoming this person. I'm not just doing these things. I am being this person.
Yeah.
That's so exciting.
It really is, yeah. So that's a really great message for anybody having any type of challenge. I'm sure there'll be other people as well that think, wow, you know, it sounds amazing what she does. You've painted the picture of being a lawyer in a much broader way than I've heard before. Because, you know, when we think of lawyers, we do think of them litigating and poring over huge tomes of documents and things. But you're right, you know, there is negotiation and marketing and a very personable side that needs a lot of personal skills. I actually know one lawyer, I did an interview with him, also works for a big law firm, and he didn't start until much later in life. He was actually in retail and then he joined law, so he didn't start right at the beginning. So you can join this profession at a later date, can't
you? Absolutely.
But if anyone wanted to join your profession now, what would you say about that? Would you recommend it? Is there a particular area? Would you say...
I would absolutely recommend it. I would absolutely recommend it if you have sort of intellectual curiosity, particularly if you're interested in business or the corporate world or banking, financial institutions, which tends to be where I have worked. I think it's good in the sense that you, as a lawyer, you get such an interesting overview over the sort of the span of a business, of an organization, and the challenges it faces. So you're not just looking at a particular area of the business. You're actually looking at the whole of the business and managing the risks for the whole of the business. So I still think it's fascinating. I think there are many more routes to entry to the legal profession than there were when I was a trainee, which is fantastic because...
Yeah, you can do a legal apprenticeship.
Exactly.
You don't have to be Cambridge educated. Yeah. You can do conversion courses. Yeah, there's a whole lot
of some
of
that
groups.
Wasn't available when I was a baby junior.
How about getting a job, your very first job into a law firm? How challenging is that now, do you think?
I think it is hard, but I have to say the candidates that we see these days, I look at the CVs or I meet them in interviews and I'm like, oh my God, I was half the 22-year-old you are when I was 22. Like, I had done far fewer things. And these days, their CVs are enormous. They've done all of this extracurricular stuff. Some of them have set up startups. They've run charities. They've banked so much more experience than we had.
And that's useful and important, isn't it? Mm. I think sometimes, you know, they don't have to jump straight into a decision about what type of career they want. Youngsters especially.
Yeah.
You know, having all these experiences is important. But equally, midlife people who maybe they had been in retail or they've done something else, to do a conversion, it's never too late.
Yeah.
And particularly with us living longer, and let's talk about longevity for a little bit. I mean, the other sort of person who may be listening to this is someone who is not happy in their body at the moment. Maybe like you, you know, they've had children and maybe they're heavier than they want to be. Maybe there's no way that they could envisage themselves ever lifting weights. And maybe they're midlife as well. And a lot of females especially, they buy into that whole idea that their hormones have changed. They now have to just put up with a midlife body and it's all downhill from here.
Yeah.
So obviously you've had this transformative experience, as have I. What would you say to them about getting started? And
it's never too late.
Yeah.
I would say it's never too late. When I was pregnant with our third child, I didn't realise I was pregnant, and I thought what I was experiencing was perimenopause.
Right.
That's the point in life that I am and was at.
Yeah.
I thought those symptoms were just the onset of the menopause. I was like, well,
yeah,
it was bound to happen sooner or later. But I've come from that to building this body where I feel so much stronger than I thought that I could be. I am smaller than I was as a teenager.
Yeah.
I feel like an athlete. I think more clearly. I thrive on my ideas. And all of that has happened in this chapter of my life where I would otherwise have been sort of winding down or just settling into my middle-aged body and mind. And
yeah.
and just accepting the status quo and thinking, well, this is the natural order of things.
Yeah.
Well, it doesn't have to be.
Changing your body really does change everything, doesn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah, it was the catalyst for so much.
And it can be done, as you say. So any final thoughts or tips? It's been wonderful, all the advice that you've given us, I must say. Everything from, you know, mindset to body to business. Any final tips? And I'd love to know as well, future for you. Things that you're thinking of. I know you've gone more into thought leadership. I've seen some of your fascinating posts on LinkedIn. I won't profess to understand all of it, but you know, you've done some great things already. I'm excited to see what else you're going to be talking about. Tell us a bit more about that.
I don't know exactly what the future holds for me, but if there is a pattern to be identified in my life's journey, is that it's always been fun. I've always been able to find what is fun in most experiences. A lot of it has been, you know, miserable and exhausting and stressful, but there's always been an element of fun. I often say to my husband, like, I lived a whole life before we met, and it was full and rich, and now I have this other life that is full and rich, and how fortunate am I? So that in this chapter I'm still finding ways of having an abundant, fun and interesting and stimulating life. I think if you can find what is fun for you, I think that feeds into longevity as well.
Definitely. I mean, according to the research now, and I've been on a lot of longevity programs, as you know, and if you listen to the scientists and the researchers, they say that we should be routinely living beyond 120, and, you know, not in any sort of debilitated state either, being as strong and vibrant as we are now. Some even talk about 150 and beyond, but 120 routinely, and we're already seeing people well into their 100s. If we work on our bodies at this point in our life, then there's no reason to think that you've talked about two sort of significant phases of your life where you won't have a third and a fourth and a fifth, and that goes for everybody. So yeah, I think that whole point of it's never too late, so important for people to dwell on and believe and look for examples of that. I know that you have sat on a couple of panels and you're going to do more of that. And in terms of areas of influence, I mean, I think you could talk on a whole variety of things that people would love to hear on, ranging from what it's like to do that type of career and to advise people in that world, but also working mothers, midlife professionals, those that may be, you know, younger people who've had the sort of challenging backgrounds that you've talked about, and how they can progress from there. I mean, there's lots of areas, I think, that you could really influence on. So where's your passion, or is it all of those? God, where are we going to see cheers later?
I don't have an answer, but it's really interesting hearing you list out those things as though I'm a subject matter expert for any of them, and maybe I am, I don't know. It's not something that I've properly explored, but it is, it's really cool to think that I have things to say on any of those topics that people might be interested in hearing. And a year ago I wouldn't have thought that that was possible, that was a me that I could be, but I suppose I can speak to a bunch of those things and say something useful and meaningful and constructive that moves the needle in those areas. It's really cool to think of myself in those terms.
And I think just one final point that I wanted to say was, fun fact of your dress is absolutely beautiful.
Thank you.
I mean, you know, you can go through life and do all of these things and still look totally feminine and beautiful and as you do today. So where's your dress from?
I don't know. My husband bought it for me.
Did he? How lovely. Yeah. Well, you look fab. You really do.
Thank you.
And it's been such a pleasure talking to you and a pleasure working with you as well. So
thank you
so much. Thanks very much.
Appreciate it.